This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The mystery of what exactly happened to the lost colony is still unknown, but archaeologists are uncovering clues as to what life was like for colonists who were part of the first English settlement attempt in the New World. Earlier this month, archaeologists discovered several pottery shards on Roanoke Island near Fort Raleigh, dating back to the 16th century. This week, I spoke with Eric Dietz, a member of the First Colony Foundation, the archaeological group investigating the Fort Raleigh settlement. He's also the adjunct lecturer in archaeology and anthropology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
We were working together with SEAC, the Southeastern Archaeological Center for the National Park Service, and they were doing a survey along the shoreline. The First Colony Foundation has been doing archaeology out at Roanoke Island for over 20 years, but the SEAC, they were coming out and looking at sites that may have been in danger of shoreline erosion along the north side of the island. So they made the finds, and at their request, I was participating with the dig because I have the local expertise as far as the time period of the material and that particular site. And it was a Sunday afternoon that I was not at the site, but I was able to identify them for what they were.
When did you know, looking at these pieces, that they had uncovered something of significant historical value?
Oh, the minute I saw the pottery, I knew it was from that time period. It was very, very definitive and very distinctive type of pottery. They had told me in an email that they had found some what's called a tin-glazed earthenware or a Delftware. Now, this is a type of pottery that the technology was used for a couple hundred years, but it's the form that really told me that it was from the right time period. It's very much like if you said you found a piece of a car, and if you found a tail fin, you knew it would have to date from 1957 to 1960. So even though cars, you know, have been going on for over 100 years, it's the same sort of thing. Even though the type of wear or the technology used to make the pottery has a broad date range, that small little apothecary jar, very delicate little apothecary jar, is something that would really only be around for about 1570 to the 1620s maybe.
And how was that piece of pottery used?
There are little apothecary jars. They would have been used generally by doctors, physicians, surgeons. It's people doing scientific work. They'd be used for either holding ointments or salves. You could be collecting botanical specimens and keeping them in them. They're just the fairly inexpensive little jars for keeping, you know, any sort of things. But they're usually associated with, you know, hence the name apothecary jars. People doing either medical, or you often find them also in like scientific workshops.
So the pieces that you found, can you describe what they look like? How big are they? What color are they?
Well, there was 8 pieces in total, and there are a couple of them are sort of 2 centimeters by 2 centimeters, and they're a white glazed pottery that has a sort of a roughly painted blue design, stripes and hatch marks. So they're sort of white on the interior and then sort of a blue and white. And there looks like there might have been a little touch of yellow, which also shows up on these things from time to time.
Can you tell me about the sites on Roanoke Island where these pieces were found and what other artifacts have been uncovered there?
Yeah, it's not as though we had found the first evidence at all. We were only about 75 meters from Fort Raleigh. There was work done there in the 1940s by J.C. Harrington, and he uncovered a good part of the earthworks. He also did some more work in the 1960s and found other small defensive features. Ivor Noel Hume in the 1990s went out with sort of the predecessors to our group, went out and found a science workshop. They found some of these little drug jar fragments like we found. They found pieces of crucible, piece of another type of pottery, sort of little bits of ceramic that would be typical of somebody doing metalworking. So this was a new area where we had not found material from that time period.
Basically, these pottery pieces were found away from the actual fort. What does that tell you as an archaeologist?
So it's encouraging. What's interesting is we have found in the past, through all the different archaeologists that have been out there, found what seem to be sort of little satellite operations or activity areas. What no one has come across is the area where everybody lived. There was over 100 people at one point, and they had to live in, you know, there were houses in a large sort of fenced-in, fortified town, if you will, and that evidence of that has not been found, and these finds don't necessarily shed any light on that either.
So here's the big question, Eric. Do these pottery pieces give any sort of clue as to what happened to the colony there at Roanoke that would eventually become the lost colony?
No. when people often talk about the Lost Colony, they're talking about where they left. You know, when John White comes back after going back to England, he comes back and there's, you know, Croatan is written on a tree or the palisade post. And then they don't know where all the folks left. And that's what's often referred to as the Lost Colony. So these sherds that we found really are from the home base, if you will, and wouldn't relate to wherever they went to, which is one of the big mysteries. It's still lost. We haven't solved that mystery.
What is the takeaway, and what do these artifacts tell about the people that once lived there?
It's more further information about the site itself, and it may give us ideas potentially of other activity areas on Roanoke Island where the original settlement would have been doing their scientific experiments or living or collecting samples, botanical samples, things like that.
Are you going to be digging at the site anytime soon?
So there's not immediate plans to go back and dig in that spot. You sort of have to gather your wits, get a good plan together, and a research design in order to do further work. But these new finds would certainly have increased interest in this particular area at the park.
Eric Dietz is a member of the First Colony Foundation and an adjunct lecturer in archaeology and anthropology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Eric, thanks for speaking with me.
All right, you bet.
Today on the Down East Journal, we continue our series, Beyond Binary, which explores the changing demographics of our area. Eastern North Carolina is among the key notches on the Bible Belt. Houses of worship can be found on most remote country roads, and it isn't uncommon to see their lots filled to the brim at least twice a week. But as Chris Thomas reports, secularism's reemergence in America hasn't exempted Eastern North Carolina.
Gallup polls over the years have rated North Carolina as one of the most religious states in the Union, placing 9th in the most recent study, published February 4th. Worship services are a virtually compulsory ritual for many across eastern North Carolina. That was once the case for Victor Steed, a Wilson native.
I was born in a very traditional African-American home, church every Sunday, whether you wanted to go or not.
As Victor grew up, they gradually felt their connection to the church loosen until, in spirit, it had been severed. Victor is part of a trend in which a growing number of Americans are opting out of organized religion and are sometimes called the nuns, spelled N-O-N-E-S, not to be confused with the similar sounding, though decidedly religious, nuns. Victor no longer attends services regularly, and these days, their Sunday morning routine is a little more leisurely.
A typical Sunday with me begins with me waking up maybe at 1:30 p.m. I spend the entire day at home, or I go out with some friends, and we just spend the day around town, going out to eat, just hanging out, maybe some shopping or something like that.
According to the off-cited study published by Pew Research Center last year, the percentage of religiously affiliated adults dropped from 83% in 2007 to 77% in 2014. The trend is even stronger among Victor's generation, millennials, those born between 1981 and 1996. Less than half of millennials polled say religion is an important part of their lives, and barely half say they believe in God with absolute certainty.
I understand that there is, that no one can really know for sure that there is a God or that there is any supernatural entity in the world. And so, I mean, I recognize the fact that I recognize the possibility of there being nothing and there also being something.
Victor says coming out as a secular person in an especially religious place like Eastern North Carolina can be a perilous situation. It wasn't made much better for them since they said they were outed before they were ready to do it themselves. Their parents were not okay with their child's deviation from what they saw as the right path, Victor said.
One thing they kept saying is, like, you know the way, you know the way, you know the right way. Like, you were brought up right, you were taught right. And I'm just like, I was only taught one way. I was taught the right way in your eyes, but I mean, in somebody else's eyes, I was taught in the completely incorrect way. You know what I mean? There are so many different ways.
Since they started living their life as a secular person, they noticed strange things about the region's relationship with faith, things that were once as normal as breathing to them. A common example is seen at restaurants, like the one Victor used to work for, when a family comes in for a meal.
And I walk away. because they ask me if they want salt and pepper or something like that, and I walk away from the table, and I come back, and I have to, like, stop for, like, a minute or two while they say grace, and I just have to stand there for that 2 minutes just to wait for them to finish, knowing I got other tables. But at the same time, it's just, it's not really inconvenient. It's just you notice how, when you believe and when you don't believe, how people treat you.
But this may not be a sign of the United States becoming an atheistic, much less anti-religious, nation anytime soon. ACU sociology professor Susan Pierce is a member of the religious studies program at East Carolina University. This interview was recorded at a cafe near downtown Greenville.
One thing that we know from, at least from Pew's research, is that the nuns are not necessarily anti-religious. So there continue to be people who are religiously unaffiliated who still say religion is important, or they say that they are spiritual, but just not in a, you know, more institutionalized way.
Studies have shown more prosperous nations tend to be the least religious. But in this case, American exceptionalism cannot be denied. The U.S. is number one in all major measurements of gross domestic product among sovereign nations. Among the world's 25 most prosperous nations, it's also one of the more religious. About two-thirds of American adults say religion is an important part of their daily lives, according to a 2010 poll. Among the world's industrialized nations on both hemispheres, Pierce says the United States is a latecomer to the secular party.
And so what I'm wondering about what's going on now is whether there is, among the millennials especially, more of less of a stigma to saying that you're a non-believer and less of a stigma to being spiritual in a deinstitutionalized sense than there was in the past.
Religion is deeply interwoven in the American narrative, especially in the South. But that may not have always been the case from the start. Deism was popular among many Western intellectual circles during the late 18th century, including the blossoming American Republic. A member of those circles? Chowan County native Cornelius Harnett, who led the North Carolina Committee of Correspondence just before the start of the Revolution. By the signing of the Treaty of Paris in 1783, ending the Revolution, church attendance was low throughout the new nation. Very low. Nowhere was it lower in the former colonies than North Carolina, which reported a diminutive 4% church attendance rate, according to a 1996 historical study.
To some extent, we could speak of the United States as going through cycles. We've had several great awakenings, as you know. So, you know, we go through times of religious revival. And I think that we actually had a recent one. I would say maybe in the 90s, early 2000s, I saw a real spike in religion, in interest in religion. So that's why it's hard to predict about whether this is now a new pattern toward a kind of generational transition toward secularization, because who knows whether we'll have another revival.
Dr. Pierce says she doesn't foresee the end of religion in eastern North Carolina or anywhere else in the U.S. Instead, she sees an era of expanded pluralism in which hijabs and pictures of Adams, the adopted symbol of the secular community, will be as common as metallic crosses and wooden rosaries.
One of the things we are seeing is more immigration to what we call new gateways in the U.S. And so in North Carolina, for example, my students are going to be much more exposed to religious diversity than they were 20 years ago in this state.
Victor says religion isn't inherently harmful, but hopes present and future non-religiously affiliated individuals will inherit a more tolerant and inclusive country.
It would be a world where people understood that having different beliefs and different understandings is okay. And just because someone believes differently doesn't make them your enemy. It just means that that's something more for you to learn, something someone else for you to learn from.
The fact is, pluralism is becoming a more common aspect of American life, in which matters that were once polarized are now deeply nuanced. And people are now found on spectrums instead of opposing camps. In more ways than we may realize, we're all living beyond binary. I'm Chris Thomas.
Public Radio East is the proud media sponsor for the Beaufort Historical Association's Old Homes and Gardens Tour and the Antique Show and Sale this weekend. It's your opportunity to explore some of Beaufort's architectural treasures and then browse more than 40 booths of regional vendors at the Antique Show at the Civic Center in Morehead City. Today, Mac McKee speaks with the executive director of the Beaufort Historical Association, Patricia Suggs, about the festivities.
Beaufort has such a rich historical tradition. It's hard to believe that the 56th annual Beaufort Old Homes and Gardens Tour is upon us once again. How long does the planning process take before each tour every year?
We start immediately after the previous tour.
What are the criteria for choosing various homes to be on the tour from year to year?
Well, our ideal situation is if they're within walking distance in the town of Beaufort. So we try to keep them in maybe a 10-block radius, but then we oftentimes go outside of that just because we have a great home that's outside of the area. And what we do every year is try to have different homes that haven't been on the tour in at least 5 years or more. And we're very fortunate this year that most of them have never been on the tour ever.
Does this tour, year's tour, have a specific theme?
We really don't have a theme other than what's unique this year is that this is a very, very first for the Old Homes Tour is to have a brand new home, but a modernism house built similar to a Frank Lloyd Wright house. They've done such a good job and nestled it within the neighborhood. It's just amazing what they've done.
What other homes and periods will be featured during this year's tour?
Well, the oldest home is 1778, and that's one that's on the historic site. But the majority of the homes are either mid to late 1800s, and then some that are early 1900s.
Now, how long does the tour last?
The private homes are open from 10 to 5 on both Friday and Saturday. So you can go view a few homes, go eat lunch, go view some more, do something totally different, and then come back the next day and do a few more if you want. Or if you're extremely serious about just doing it in a very short period of time, you can do that also by getting on our courtesy vans or our golf carts and just racing from one location to the next. But we all prefer the more leisurely stroll through the town.
How did the Beaufort Historical Association and the Antique Show and Sale join forces?
Actually, the tour was started by the Beaufort Woman's Club back in 1960, and they soon found that it became too big for them to handle, so they turned it over to the Beaufort Historical Association. The Antique Show, they started that also, and it was basically people would had antiques in the back of their cars, and they had a little antique trunk show that they did during the tour.
That has kept on as part of the tradition of the show ever since then.
That's right.
In addition to the private homes and gardens, don't miss the homes on the historic site and the narrated bus tours for the historic district because they're always entertaining.
Oh, they are. And in addition, we have artists with their art studios open that you can go tour.
Now, how has the tour grown in the last several years that you've been involved, and you've been involved almost 20 years?
It just keeps continuing to grow in the hospitality of the town and the ability to have the different restaurants involved and even the youth groups in the church. So it's a good fundraiser all around town.
It's a ticketed event for the Old Homes and Gardens Tour. If you need more information, you can always visit the events calendar at publicradioeast.org.
And that's
I want to thank you so much, Patricia, for being our guest today.
Well, thank you so much.
My name's Andrea Beal. I live in Newport and Carteret County. I've been listening since we moved here in July of last year. I listen continuously because I love it. I listen to it all the way to work. I drive 35 miles round trip every day, and that's what I listen to back and forth every day when I drive because it keeps me up to date with what's going on, not only nationally, internationally, but local, and it provides interesting stories that pique my interest and I love to listen to. I would hate to see a programming like that to leave the air because I love it so much. It's just a small contribution to help the station continue. My name's Andrea Beal, and I live in Newport I am Public Radio East.
As we try to wrap up Public Radio East's fiscal year on goal, we encourage everyone who listens to make a quick pledge of support. The fact is, listener dollars keep your favorite programs on the air. Won't you make a membership pledge right now in any amount? You can pledge by phone at 1-800-222-9832, give online at publicradioeast.org, or you can mail back your pledge card to Public Radio East, 800 College Court, New Bern, NC, 28562. And thank you.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. As the weather heats up, bees, wasps, and other insects become more active. I expect to get more calls about carpenter bees. Carpenter bees are large bees resembling bumblebees that drill holes in wood to make their nests. This becomes an issue when they choose to use your house or outbuilding for their nesting location. These carpenter bees are not aggressive. In fact, the males don't sting at all, and the females usually only sting if handled. But they can be very intimidating due to their large size and impressively loud buzzing. Carpenter bees can be distinguished from bumblebees by their black, shiny tail section and distinctive behavior. People notice carpenter bees when the bees are found hovering around their homes or outbuildings. In a natural setting, carpenter bees would create their nests in dead trees. In a residential area, where most of the dead trees are taken down, the bees often utilize the timber of buildings instead. They're attracted to bare, unpainted, or weathered wood and seem to prefer softwoods like cedar, cypress, and pine. The adult carpenter bees overwinter in the wood inside the old nest tunnels. They emerge in the spring to mate and excavate new tunnels in which they lay eggs. Controlling carpenter bees may require multiple approaches. First, paint all exposed wooden surfaces to make them less appealing. Polyurethane or oil-based paints work best. If carpenter bees are still an issue, enterprising homeowners can use a tennis racket to eliminate small numbers of bees. Traps are an appealing, although not always effective, control measure. Carpenter bee traps typically consist of a small block of wood with a hole drilled in it that leads the bees, when they investigate the hole, into a bottle or other container that they cannot escape from. As a final resort, you can eliminate carpenter bees by spraying an insecticide into the hole and closing the hole with putty, caulk, or plastic wood. You may need to treat them several times to get an infestation under control. If carpenter bees are nesting in an area where their damage can be tolerated, remember that they are native pollinators. They forage in early morning and are excellent pollinators of many plants, including eggplant, tomato, other vegetables, and many types of flowers. These large bees excel at buzz pollination. That's the process of using the power of their wing vibrations to transfer pollen to the stigma inside the closed flower. So keep a lookout for carpenter bees this month, and consider leaving a piece of untreated wood for the bees to nest in.
Coming up this weekend, Rivertown's Rising Stars present a musical called Boomslang in downtown New Bern.
My name is Aaron Williams, and I'm the director of Camp Broadway at Rivertown Players. It's like an Oliver, Annie superhero mix. It's based on two young and up-and-coming individuals, which is the headmaster and the headmistress, who come to work for St. Alexander and St. Francis, the boys and girls orphanage that has been combined because of finances. It takes a look into the lives of six men kids, and one full stormy night, there comes to life a witness of a heartbreaking journey about these kids. And when the moon brightens and lightning strikes, all six kids are changed. They are turned into superheroes. And then the evil Boomslang, which is the villain, threatens to destroy New York, and it ends up to the kids to find their inner strength to battle them once and for all. It's at Rivertown Players Theater, which is called Masonic Theater, and that's located on Hancock Street in New Bern, North Carolina. The dates are June 24th at 7 p.m. and June 25th at 2 p.m. For more information on this nonprofit event, go to publicradioeast.org's event calendar.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a nice weekend.
Hi, this is Ken Meads, the softer sounds of Jazz Man. Softer Sounds is different from any jazz program you ever heard before, because you'll know all the tunes. You don't need to be a card-carrying jazz fan to enjoy this program. You just have to enjoy the best popular music ever written. Softer Sounds of Jazz is Saturday nights at 8 o'clock over PRE, Public Radio East, 89.3.